Hello and welcome to Policy Pathways, the new podcast series focusing on the policy challenges of food, land and water systems transformation. The project is brought to you by the CGIAR's National Policies and Strategies Initiative and is produced by the International Water Management Institute, IMI. My name is Chavi Sachdev. I'm a journalist from Mumbai, India. This is the final episode in the Policy Pathways series. We're going to be looking back on some of the discussions we've had about the CGIAR's National Policies and Strategies Initiative Policy Coherence Reports from the six countries that the project has been focusing on: Colombia, Egypt, India, Kenya, Laos, and Nigeria. To help us do this, we've assembled an accomplished panel of guests to try to look at some of the big themes and challenges that emerged throughout our discussions in the series. What policy challenges in the food, land, and water sectors do countries share? And are there challenges particular to countries or regions? And we're also going to try to look at policy coherence as a whole. Are countries managing to streamline policy decision-making and improve implementation? Joining us today are Policy Pathways Executive Producer, NPS Co-Lead, and IMI Principal Researcher, Dr. Alan Nicol, Dr. Augusto Castro Nunez, Senior Researcher and Program Lead at Alliance of Biodiversity and the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, and finally, Dr. Inga Jacobs-Mata, IMI Strategic Program Director of Water Growth and Inclusion. Welcome to you all.
Hi, Chavi. Great to be with you again.
Hi, Chavi.
Great to be here. Hi.
Thank you all so much for being here. I think it would be useful to recap and possibly ask why the CGIAR's NPS initiative decided to commission these policy coherence reports. Clearly, previous research has suggested how policy in food, land, and water systems is developed. We've talked many times over the last episodes about how policy is traditionally developed in silos and that policy coherence is something governments around the world are struggling with. Alan, is this why the reports focus on countries in the global south?
Yeah, so we launched this process about 2.5 years ago, and the idea was to start with policy landscape mapping, really, of these six countries. Although they're all in the global south, and certainly the CGIAR's constituency is really small farmers in the global south, you know, policy coherence is a much wider challenge. So we hope, indeed, our results at the end of the process will be relevant to a much larger selection of countries. But those six countries were countries where we already had an established presence, and we had work, and we could build policy partnerships relatively quickly. So building on the policy landscape analysis and the policy coherence reports, we could then deep dive into some more specific areas and look at the policy challenges surrounding, for instance, food and water systems issues in Laos or in Colombia or in Egypt. So the idea was to kind of identify those core issues and to start looking at some of them, at least in more detail, and to do that in a collaborative way. And that's the second really key part of this process. And that was to develop these reports collaboratively with partners, with policy partners in different countries, and to use those policy partnerships as a way into really understanding the detail and the particular policy coherence contexts in those specific countries.
Thank you. So we'll definitely come back to partnerships and the deep dives, but let's move on to the big themes, the big challenges, if you will, that seem to have emerged from these reports. But you've also been listening, we hope, to all the podcast episodes. What are the biggest challenges policymakers face? What has struck you while you've been hearing about all the six reports?
At the formulation level, we found out, at least in Colombia, and we can generalize probably this at global scale, that policy is coherent between land, food systems, and also water systems. The issue comes at the implementation scale. When we implement, probably we can find some incoherence between policies. And probably this is because different sectors have different priorities and the actions they implement for achieving their respective objective can create a trade-off between the different actions on the ground. Another challenge we've identified is that sometimes funding is not an issue. Some countries are developing, particularly in Latin America. However, the capacities to implement the actions on the ground and structure projects that can help to achieve the goals of the policies is the complicated part of this. Meaning the money is there, but not necessarily the capacities to spend the money. I would say those are the two main challenges that we are facing and we are identifying after the analysis we did in Colombia.
It seems fair to say that across the board, the countries the NPS reports have focused on do seem to be developing policy. But the issue, as Augusto said, is implementation. In Colombia, finance doesn't appear to be a big issue, but elsewhere, it looms large. Here's a clip from the Nigeria episode, first from Professor Anthony Onoja and then from Dr. Charity Osei Amponsa.
You may have good policies, very good policies. Nigeria has a lot of good policies on ground related to food, land, and water. But many of these policies are not properly implemented or backed up with the relevant funding to make the policies work.
Whatever policy interventions that we are putting up, we need to put funding. So investing in those policies, it's very, very, very important. It's just not enough or sufficient to put 9 strategies in the policy document. It has to be backed with funding. We have to put budget to it, and we need to follow through its implementation. All those strategies are very good. They have to be implemented, and we need to even make sure that we evaluate the extent to which it's impacted on the type of social groups or geographical areas that were intended for. And we have to learn from our mistakes and also our successes to be able to have a better forecast for future interventions.
So is money the root of all evil for policy implementation? Inga, does your research bear this out and the research you've seen in the studies? What does having no money mean and are finances being squeezed everywhere? Is this one of the main reasons that perhaps focusing on policy coherence is so important?
I mean, I think it is certain it plays an important role, right, in the ability of countries and sectors to track the implementation of policy, certainly. But just listening to the clip, I was struck by, I'm from South Africa, right, and the amount of times I hear in my sort of national context, we have great policies, but they're unimplementable. I have to ask whether are policies really good if they are unimplementable? Do we still separate the policy design or the policy itself from the ability to have it implemented? So capacity, Augusto mentioned the capacity of decision makers or of a country to be able to implement. We also see now the World Bank, just an example, the World Bank's Food Systems Resilience Program is huge funding going to countries in Africa to transform their agri-food system. And these are largely in support of the enabling environment. Now, there the challenges are how do we get this investment into the spaces where it can really transform the lives of the beneficiaries it seeks to impact. So I don't know necessarily if the challenge is so much the lack of investment. It's rather, you know, the strategy that a country has to implement that policy.
Just building on Inga's point, is money the root of all evil? No, is a short answer, but it's a key part of the challenge, right? I mean, the studies have certainly shown a lack of funding is a hindrance, but so too is a lack of an institutional environment at a local level that enables inclusion in policy implementation or that enables a kind of level playing field in sharing data and knowledge of policy implementation processes. So there's also, you know, these sort of qualitative issues that really hinder implementation at a local level. And we've seen that both in Laos and in Kenya, certainly featuring as a major challenge. So I think, you know, money's an element, a critical element, but it's not everything. It's a part of the puzzle.
I agree with that. But examples of global scale, there's plenty of funds for integrating food and water systems and the objectives of such initiatives. But the access to those funds are complicated. And sometimes countries do not have the capacity to structure a project to access the funding. Let's say the Green Climate Fund. Not all the countries have the capacity to structure a project that get to the funds and implement the nice policies they have on the ground. So actually funding is an issue, but not necessarily the availability of funding, but the access to the funding and the capacities to access them.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So we've talked about money, access to the money, and implementation. But of course, one of the other things in this puzzle is whom will these policies benefit? And it seems that social inclusion is an area that all the focus countries still need to pay attention to. Here's Dr. Nitin Bassi, a senior program lead at the Council on Energy, Environment and Water, CEW, whom we spoke to about the NPS India report earlier.
It was really heartening to see that how these policies have an inbuilt mechanism right at the planning stage. Now, what happens is that sometimes, you know, when it is they get implemented on the ground, you know, there can be some groups, especially marginalized groups or, those who do not have access to right information, you know, they might be left out, you know, when the policies get implemented. And this is what, you know, we are also trying to address through the work that we are doing.
So people are marginalized unintentionally. And this was also reflected in the conversation about Kenya. Here's a clip from Dr. Lillian Kirimi, who is the senior research fellow at Tegemeo Institute of Agricultural Policy and Development, Egerton University. She was discussing women's roles in agriculture.
Women's roles are marginalized and vulnerable, and you could describe their roles generally as irregular, informal, part-time, low-skilled, and even labor-intensive. And I would add that they are greatly underrepresented in commercial farming. And I think policy has a role to play in addressing some of these issues that cause women not to play a big role in comparison to men.
Inga, let me ask you, clearly social inclusion is still a critical issue. Is enough being done at a policy level to try to ensure that social inclusion is improved? Or is this a leap too far for countries where, as we've heard earlier, cash is tight, funds are scarce or not accessible, and choices need to be made?
Yeah, sadly, not enough is being done, Shavi. I mean, I just came back from Bali at the World Water Forum. And for somebody working in this water sector, you know, for past 15 years, going to these water forums every 4 years, it was sad to see the same issues being advocated for more inclusion, more engagement in by youth or involvement by youth in water policy and its intersection. So I don't think enough has been done. But I will say that from some of the work we've been doing at IMI on integrating community-based approaches into statutory law, for example, once you're able to acknowledge and get community voices recognized in statutory law, we call it hybrid water law, for example. So that's really sort of getting it into law, first of all. Institutionalizing it is infinitely harder. So how do you then, once it's in a policy, once you've got community, customary water tenure, for example, or customary land tenure integrated into a national, you know, regulation, to institutionalize that at different levels, at the different tiers of government, that's where it's really difficult, because then you're dealing with who has the mandate to really implement this kind of policy. And it's one of these issues that falls between the cracks.
Yes, we've heard this again and again in all the episodes. Another thing we've heard a lot about in pretty much every episode is climate change. It's a global challenge, and managing it is a global problem. Here's a clip from our conversation about Egypt from NPS report co-author Dr. Yusuf Bruzian.
Obviously, water resources of Egypt are vulnerable to any variation in the climate pattern. So changes in the and the water resources regime definitely will risk the irrigation sector, for example. We've got also the variation or increase of temperature. So with the increase of temperature, we will have a different crop behavior. So the crop growth will be affected, with potentially dropping in agricultural productivity, in addition to drought and heat stress that will definitely impact cultivations and also animals, livestock.
These kinds of challenges are common to a lot of countries, of course, but I want to focus a little on mitigation and management strategies that will affect food, land and water systems policy. Let's just listen to a clip from the Laos podcast. This is Dr. Latsimi Funvisuk, a researcher in the National Agriculture and Forestry Research Institute in Laos Republic.
Lending season is start from June to October. This big challenge for farmers, they cannot adapt with the climate change. Also, right now in Laos, we don't have policy or strategy for the climate change. We have only agriculture and forestry and rural development strategy.
So what Dr. Latsumi is saying is that the big challenge for farmers is that it's very hard to adapt to climate change. And in Laos right now, she's saying they don't have a policy or strategy for climate change, only an agricultural policy and rural development strategy. Alan, listening back to that clip and based on the work that you do, how representative would you say that Laos' position is of other developing countries? Are other countries just firefighting on the issue with no proper strategy to manage the problem of climate change?
Big question. I mean, I don't think any country is sort of completely outside of the demands of the nationally determined contributions that they need to set. They're you know, not thinking hard about adaptation and resilience strategies. The question is really how far they've built that into a sort of comprehensive policy environment in their country. And if in Laos, indeed, it's still in its sort of nascent stages, it's a big challenge. It's a country enormously affected by climate because of its reliance on one large water system, the Mekong Basin, which itself is hugely affected by shifts in climate and indeed upstream and downstream developments and demand on the resource across different sectors, industry, agriculture, urbanization, etc. So there's a huge range of issues in Laos, not to mention the complexities of land and land management as well in that basin area. So yes, I do think it's an area that Laos will and indeed is developing slowly its policy environment around. And I think it's one that it will benefit from in many ways, sharing that experience and gaining other experience from other countries. And one of the reasons, just to say that we did this study in Laos and in the other five countries, is to help, if we can, share the experiences of these kind of policy complexes across countries. So building communities of policy practice where the example of Colombia can be shared with Laos and Kenya with Nigeria, etc. We can build better understanding of what good policy looks like and what successfully implemented policy looks like. And indeed, that's one thing we're trying to do in the coming stages of the project. But yes, I do think that they should be building, and they are indeed building slowly, their work on climate change. And I think you perhaps wonder where IMI's role comes into this. Again, facilitating knowledge brokerage, helping policymakers in one context better understand ways of constructing policy effectively and implementing it in other contexts. Advisory, yes, but increasingly we're playing a much more facilitative role. In fact, in some ways, the CGIAR is trying to avoid that moniker, this idea of expert knowledge, and trying to help build constituencies of knowledge into policy processes. So helping to facilitate that.
Inga, is there something you'd like to add about where external organizations such as IMI can really earn their money, if you like, in advising and helping to develop policy?
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, it's really about being a technical support partner to decision makers, both in the public as well as in the private sector. So how do we use the evidence generated to support policy development, policy improvement, review, but also, I would say, convening. So as Ellen mentioned, you know, providing that convening space, bringing decision makers together across countries or within regions or river basins, really providing that space where there's a gap.
Augusto, what are your thoughts on this? In the episode on Colombia, we discussed climate change, and you were very clear then that Colombia is very focused on its climate commitments and on climate targets. You'd also said that even though Colombia is a developing country, it's very keen to be seen as a leader in this debate. Is it possible for other smaller, less well-developed countries to do something similar?
It is happening already in various countries, particularly in Latin America, but as well in some countries in Southeast Asia and Africa. Those countries are taking the leadership in climate change mitigation, in promoting efforts for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So they consider that although they have contributed little to climate change, they have the opportunity to develop their countries by focusing on low emissions development, low emissions and resilience development. Peru is another example of this kind of efforts, although they are doing these kind of things, much more investment probably and access to investments is needed to make this happen.
One of my takeaways from the climate change challenge that every country seems to be facing is that this issue subsumes everything else. It creates problems and consumes resources that could otherwise be put to use tackling the issues at hand, food, land, and water policy. Well, that leads me to think about where NPS is going next. Clearly, you have a wealth of new research from the NPS studies. Alan, what are you planning for the near future?
We're using these sort of landscape mapping policy coherence analyses to identify some real hotspot issues of policy coherence. And there are a couple that have surfaced. One of them is around the intersection of these big policy areas, food, land, and water systems with migration, in the context of enormous shifts in climate change, for example, in West Africa, and also other issues around, say, wetlands management, hugely important resource in different parts of Africa and South Asia, Southeast Asia as well, and indeed in Latin America. And as climate change adds pressure to resource systems, wetlands can become sort of an intersection of pressure for food production, of land policy, of changing water systems. And we're finding that those are real hotspot issues, kind of zones of conflict around policy, if you like, that we also think may be a really valuable area to work on with partners in government and in civil society. But certainly those are two core areas that have popped up in subsequent discussions. Policy coherence is such a big area. Climate change is such a big area. In a way to use our resources effectively in future with partners, we need to zero in a little bit on some core issues like those.
Climate change, biodiversity conservation, nutrition, all these things are happening simultaneously in the territory. So finding coherence, improving coherence between different sectors would be a next step, for instance, in Colombia, but as well in other parts of the world. We are doing this in Colombia, taking advantage that the next biodiversity COP is happening here in Cali. We are working together. We are partnering WWF to inform policy discussions on how can we include the food systems perspective into the new round of plans for achieving biodiversity conservation. So that would be a nice outcome of NPS, and hopefully those discussions and those works can translate into improvement to policy instruments, including those that aim at finance actions on the ground.
Right, that's very, very important. Inga, is there anything you can add about partnerships going forward?
Yeah, and perhaps also, Shavi, just hearing Augusto's point, you know, it's clear now that the 2.7 degrees Celsius is becoming the planning point for 2100. So for me, horizontal and vertical policy coherence that we've heard a lot about needs to now also look into temporal coherence. This is sort of, you know, how do decision makers sort of reconcile and balance considerations of urgency and, you know, policy synergy as well, considering available resources. And I think this is becoming more and more key with all policy related to agri-food system transformation. So I would say I look forward to NPS and to the work of the team in helping policymakers navigate this temporal coherence that we will see more and more of in the years to come.
Indeed. I think all six of the studies and, of course, our conversations with you have given us so much direction and, may I say, hope. I know I'm not the only one following closely to see what unfolds for Colombia, Egypt, India, Kenya, Laos and Nigeria, but also wherever you focus for the next NPS studies. With that, I'll close this final episode of Policy Pathways. We will have a transcript of today's conversation available on our feed. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the Policy Pathways podcast to catch up on all the previous episodes. It just remains for me to thank Dr. Augusto Castro Nunez and Dr. Inga Jacobs-Mata and Dr. Alan Nicol for joining us today. I'm Chavi Sachdev. Studio production for Policy Pathways was by Wild Dog. Music was by Mark Peter Royce. Our series producer was Alan Nicol, and production was by Louisa Chandler Edmund for the International Water Management Institute. Our program editor was Andrew Johnstone. Thank you all for listening, and goodbye.